here comes a lady with glasses.
Oh, there's, I think there's a lady coming.
We need another one. Sorry, that was there, wasn't it? Oh, yes.
It's
all right,
she's
bringing
the
glass.
Oh, have I got the water there?
No need to
glass.
Sammy, please.
We're okay, thanks.
That one, yeah.
You want to send one of those down? Mm. Oh, that's lovely, thank you.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, may we have an expectant hush, please? My name's Andrew Taylor, I'm the participating moderator of this panel, and I write crime novels, which sounds rather like I'm an alcoholic, which may indeed be true as well. Before I introduce our panelists, if you can't hear me, or any of us, or if you can't hear any of us, let us know. If you can hear us too loudly, let us know as well. I'm sure all of you have turned your mobiles onto silence, because I can see you're that sort of audience. Before we start, I want to show you this impressive bag. This contains light literature. And I will present it to the member of the audience who asked the most interesting question. So, the other thing I want to say before I start, that I've just been assured by a member of the organising team that they will all the organising team, including Adrian Muller, will be wearing fishnet stockings this year. Isn't that amazing? I just wanted to share that one with you. Now, let me begin at the beginning. At the end, we have Jeremy Duns, who has written two Cold War spy novels so far. I think that's right, isn't it, Jeremy?
It is right, yeah.
Yep. One called Free Agent, the first one called Free Agent. The second one was going to be called Free Country, but now seems to be called The Song of Treason, which I assume is an alias, is it, because it's a spy novel? Is that correct?
Is it an alias?
Yes, I mean, it seems to have changed its name.
My publishers...
For operational reasons.
For operational reasons, yeah. My publishers have changed the title, yes.
I see.
Indeed, yeah. For classified reasons.
And there will be more in the same series.
Yes, I've just finished the third novel.
And I see they are now optioned for TV and
they
under
have been
development.
Yeah. Yes, the BBC is writing a script at the moment, which I'm waiting to see. So if there's any BBC people here,
right. And what period are they covering?
They're all set in 1969, so quite a specific period.
Yeah.
I suppose the basic premise is, what if James Bond had really been working for the KGB all along? So my narrator is a baddie. Paul Dark is a sort of Kim Philby crossed with James Bond is the basic principle of it.
Okay. Next to him, Diane James has been shortlisted twice for the debut dagger, and then her first novel, the Pull of the Moon, was shortlisted for the John Creasy. This novel is in fact set in the present, but it has a backstory set in 1972, and this is in fact the core upon which the plot of the whole novel turns. She's also written non-fiction too. One is a book called Poisonous Lies, which is an account of the Croydon arsenic mystery of 1928. And there's also Edwardian Murder, which is about the 1908 murder of Caroline Lourd, and it's very curious sequel a couple of years later. But I think your latest novel is set entirely in the present, is it, Diane?
It is, but very much like Full of the Moon, although a very different book to Full of the Moon, it's actually all about the past catching up with you, past events impacting on the present. So that's clearly very much a theme for me.
Yes, it's one of the themes that keep coming back, isn't it?
Absolutely,
yeah.
Yes.
Next along we have Kate Ellis, who has written two series, is writing two series, and I think I'm right in saying, Kate, you'll be talking about the perils and the pleasures of writing two series simultaneously later on at Crime Fest. She has been nominated twice so far for the Short Story Award and for the Barry as well. Her first series, of which there are now 15, is that right?
Features I lose count.
Well, I know, one does. Features an inspector named Wesley Peterson. And here in this series, although they're set in the present, they always turn on past events, on historical episodes, as do the plots in your second series.
Yes, there's a lot of, that's very spooky.
Set in a fictional variant of York, is that right?
Yes. Okay. You can't escape history there.
No. Which leads me neatly on to Edwin Thomas Stroke, Tom Harper, who lives in York. clever, eh? I think of Edwin as Edwin, not Tom, for reasons I won't go into here, but he has written 9 novels, is it now?
Mm-hmm.
And they have been published in 20 languages. He's the former chair of the Crime Writers Association. His first series, as Edwin Thomas, featured a man called Gerald, Martin Gerald, and was set in the Napoleonic Wars. This came to an end, unfortunately.
Yes.
And Edwin reinvented himself as Tom Harper. Maybe you can find a way to explain why. I mean, why was it necessary to invent yourself again?
Operational
reasons.
And I think probably the same operational reason of trying to sell more books.
Yes.
No, that I reinvented myself. In fact, reinvented myself twice, writing quite different sorts of books. And the publisher, it was a different publisher, wanted to differentiate the new books from the old books, or sort of the author as brand. And so a new name sort of signaled to the reader a new kind of book. And my editor had a very specific idea as to how I wanted to choose a pseudonym, that the surname should start between C and L. Because the only way people buy books, obviously, is by browsing the shelves, starting alphabetically. Not wanting to commit too soon, you won't commit to the A's or the B's. You get warmed up by the C's, but frankly, you're never going to make it more than halfway, so anything past L doesn't stand a chance.
That's always struck me as very good advice. My name's Taylor, of course. Yours was
Thomas. Yeah.
If only I had similar advice at a crucial moment in my career earlier. As Tom Harper, though, you've changed, really.
Mm.
You've become not... You've acquired not merely a new name, but also a new literary personality to go with it. The first 3 novels as Tom Harper was set in the Middle Ages. 2 of them with the Crusades as the backdrop.
All 3 of them really.
All 3.
Crusades, yeah.
But later you've moved into the present again, but always with a backstory set very firmly in the more mysterious areas of the past.
The last 2 and now the next novel coming out this summer have all been time slip novels, which I'm sure you all know is the one where you have a modern story alternating, in this case chapter by chapter, with a historical story, given more or less equal weight in the storytelling, which is very germane to this panel, and just a wonderful framework to work in if you love history. And also love the ways it does kind of come into the present, and the links between past and present, because you can write these 2 stories which intersect on various levels, and which sort of pull out the parallels and show the things that change and the things which don't change.
In this panel, we're going to be talking talking about once upon a time when the past comes into the present, which is one of those sort of lovely broad titles. We can more or less talk about whatever we like, but it has to have something to do with the past. But my first, the first point I'd like to throw into the panelists, I think of them as a ravening lions, and I'm chunking the odd chunk of meat, is that is most crime fiction in general, and your crime fiction in particular, and indeed crime fact, is it concerned with the past almost intrinsically, since it's almost always about investigating past causes of crimes in the present or in the fictional past present. What would you say to that, Kate? I mean, how would you find that with your books?
I would totally agree, because my books are very similar to Tom that Edwin described, using a past case and a present case almost in time slip. But even if I was writing one purely in the present day, I don't see how you could avoid the past, really, on a psychological level. Because old sins have had long shadows, isn't that what Agatha Christie used to say? And I think probably the only crime books that wouldn't have its roots in the past are perhaps gangster books, organised crime, that sort of thing.
Where the action ripples on from the start, from one event at the start, yeah.
But I don't tend to do that sort of book, so yes, definitely, I would always use the past.
I mean, perhaps we should have begun by saying, what is the past? What do we think of as the past? Diane, I mean, you've set a book that turns on events in 1972. Is that the past for you? Is that sort of real history now?
Well, because I'm so old, 1972 isn't real history to me. But to my children, it's a time that possibly is just after the dinosaurs became extinct. Or maybe around the same time even, I don't know. I think that really is a fundamentally interesting question. What is the past? I mean, the new one, Why Don't You Come For Me Again, is about someone's past. Mm. And they are events, really, which only took place in the 80s and the 90s. But the thing about the past is that as soon as it's gone, I mean, even as soon as an hour has gone by, there's this question about what really happened, isn't there, and where you're getting your information from. They say that, major history is written by the winners. Even if you go to just an ordinary family event within your family, someone starts telling this well-loved anecdote and someone will inevitably interrupt and say, no, you haven't got that right, because Auntie Mary wasn't there that day or whatever. And that in itself fascinates me, the question of actually what really happened and different people's take on the past, different people's perception of the past. And I think that's true of all past events, events of an hour ago and events of 1,000 years ago.
But sometimes, presumably, the past has a very different meaning, as in your novels, Jeremy. I mean, that you couldn't write a Cold War novel set now, for example, or even 5 years ago. It has to be a particular time frame.
No, you couldn't. And in fact, I couldn't have written the novels that I'm writing now during the Cold War either, for various reasons. I mean, first of all, it would have been much harder for audiences to have accepted a traitor as a narrator during the Cold War when it was live, but also there's an awful lot of stuff that's been declassified, so that there's things that weren't known that perhaps were suspected that we can now reasonably think happened. Although I agree with you, I mean, I also find that fascinating, that you can't really ever know actually what happened, even if you have a declassified government document. How do you know that government document isn't part of a misinformation program, and you could find another document later that would say document A that you read was actually a fake? I mean, it's a serious problem, because you can't really very easily piece together what really happened in the Cold War, even though it happened 50 years ago. There's very little that's been released from Russia. MI6 has never declassified a single file. The CIA, on the other hand, has declassified hundreds of thousands of files. So you have quite a bizarre situation where you have sort of joint MI6 and CIA operations where you can read British secrets online, you know, from the Cold War that the British government has never declassified and probably never will.
Mm.
So there's a sort of imbalance in it. And I think that, for me, is possibly the most interesting aspect of looking at the past. It's a sort of, in a way, frustrating, never-ending process. You can't really ever get to any absolute truth. But it's quite a lot of fun trying.
What drew you to that particular period, though?
I don't know. I don't know why I'm drawn to the Cold War. I preferred the Secret Seven to the Famous Five when I was a boy.
Well, that tells us a lot.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't know.
Oh,
yes.
Now, about 10 years ago, I think, I went into a second-hand bookshop in Antwerp, and they had lots of English second-hand thrillers, and I picked up for very little money an old Cold War thriller called The Quiller Memorandum.
And
I read that book, and I just thought, I'd heard of it, but I'd never read it. And I just read it, I thought, this is absolutely brilliant. I mean, what an amazing book. And so I then read all of that series. He wrote 19 books, which are absolutely brilliant spy novels, and became quite sort of obsessed with Adam Hall, the writer of that, and then read lots of other, sort of revisited Len Deighton, who I'd read before, but I read lots and lots of spy fiction, and kind of honed in on the 60s particularly as a sort of peak of the Cold War, and thought, you know, I'd quite like to give it a go. You know.
So it came
so
through the fiction, an interest
yeah.
in that particular period.
Yeah,
and then I did
research into the real stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is. If we look at this from another angle, what advantages does having crimes in the past over crimes have over crimes in the present? Edwin, I mean, damn, Tom.
Edward, give you my historical name. I really like working with the past because I think it's a very pure fictional space in which to operate as a writer, because so much of the detail, however much research you do, so much of the detail is stripped away that you can concentrate on a very much sort of blanker canvas to kind of impose your will, and without people coming up and saying that's totally unrealistic, that couldn't have happened, and I know because I am the person who does that job today. One of the things I found interesting was I'd written 7 historically set novels before I wrote anything set in the present day, and it took me 3 days to try and write the first page of that story.
CIA.
Yeah. this never happens in historical novels.
Maybe we should solve this mystery.
It took me 3 days to write the first page of anything set in the present day, and the reason was because after you've sort of sucked from the little sort of dribbling hose pipe of historical fact, suddenly to drink from the fire hose of the modern day, where you know absolutely everything, every sort of speck of dust, you can just look around and see a million details, and try to filter that out to just get the absolute key details onto the page to tell the story is actually much, much harder. Whereas with working with history, there's less to work with, so everything becomes more important, and it's sort of easier to figure out what's important.
Is there perhaps another reason, though, in that fiction set in the past, crime fiction, it's not sort of cursed by all the modern paraphernalia, forensic science, police procedural, no genetic fingerprinting, no GPS, no mobile phones, and that has implications, I think, for the sort of novels that can be written on that basis, because you can focus on the people, on the crimes, on the situations, on the settings, on the problems, rather than have to worry about the mechanics, the sheer pseudo-scientific mechanics, which, are we interested in those, panel? What do you think? Diane, are you interested in that?
I'm kind of fortunate in that the police are only very peripherally mentioned in my novels. I write psychological thrillers, which are rather more concerned with the people who are involved. In order to get CSI and the police involved, the police have actually got to know that something has happened in the
just wants is for the police not to actually find out that anything ever happened at all. So that rather gets me over the hurdle of the CSI and forensics and so on. Before we actually had a sort of minor interruption, I was going to say that I quite like mobile phones not to be available in the period that I'm writing about, but I think that now sounds like I'm having a dig at someone, so I haven't actually said that. Going back even just a little way in the 20th century, you actually find it's quite interesting. If you're writing even about something that happened in the early 90s, most people in Britain didn't actually have a mobile phone at that point. and it, so you don't actually have to go back all that far.
No.
To
or
get
computers.
Rid of modern
or computers.
Absolutely, yeah. The internet, again, which has really changed the ease with which you can find people and find out about things.
Yeah.
Kate, I mean, how do you feel on that? Because you're the other one who writes two series set in the present and yet with the past thing. I mean, but how do you find that all that modern stuff?
Well, I love doing historical research, but I often find I need to do as much research on the modern stuff, the technology.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a bit of a... Well, I can use a computer, you know, but a mobile phone on a basic level. But I always have to go and ask my son or my husband, you know, is this possible? You know, it's about signal.
We seem to have a bit of an echo on
like
this.
That.
Excuse me. Is something we can do about that?
Feedback.
We're getting feedback.
There is feedback, yeah.
So I do think it's as demanding in a way for someone like me to write about the present, and also it's quite annoying if you want to delay a discovery, and yet I'm working on a book at the moment, and I want this woman to be uncontactable in somewhere. So that they think she's possibly the victim. I hope I'm not giving too much away. But I had to ask my husband, you know, where can't you get a mobile signal, you know, and all that. Oh, the trouble is, he says, you can get it one almost anywhere these days. Oh no! Back to the drawing board.
That leads us on to research, actually, rather neatly. I mean. Historical research or research into the past, and I'm using history in a broad sense here, because even to research the 1970s or the 1960s, you need to do quite a lot of hard work if you're going to actually get back into what people were engaged in and thinking about and the novels they were reading or the products they were using in order to find out that sort of thing. How do you do your research?
It depends on the book I'm writing, obviously, but I spend a lot of time in libraries is the main answer. Even in this day, Google and the internet and everything, I think there's still a depth of information that you get from books, particularly scholarly books, that is just still, in a lot of cases, not available online. And I read as much as possible as I can from primary sources. And on the lift up, we were talking about how we did our research and how... we wouldn't trust any book which didn't have footnotes, because without the footnote you can't find out where it's come from. And the author could just be making any kind of bold statement. And ultimately what you want is you want a footnote that leads you back to a primary source, because that's where you get the voice of the person who lived in that era telling you what they were actually thinking about and what they were actually doing. Even then, I mean, that's still imperfect. We're talking about variation in history. Also, you know, what people remember and how accurate it can be. My first novel is Tom Harper, The Mosaic of Shadows. The climax is this battle at the gates of Byzantium, which is described vividly by Anna Komnina, who's a Byzantine princess whose father is the emperor, who is there, who probably witnesses the battle, and writes in her memoirs, which is an extraordinary document, this description of the battle, which I took pretty much verbatim as the basis for my novel. And about 6 months after it was published, I had an email from a historian of the period who said, I really enjoyed your novel, and particularly the climax, but you do know that battle probably never happened. What? How? And it turns out there are a bunch of other sources which flatly contradict this source that I'd used. And on balance, this historian thought it hadn't happened. So even an eyewitness isn't necessarily an eyewitness. But a lot of research and a lot of walking the ground of where places things have happened. I'm a great believer you have to, certainly for me, for my sort of the way I write, I have to have stood in a place and seen what's all around to write about it, even though I'm writing about it 2,000 years after, since it was the way it was.
Well, Jeremy, are you, is your research partly meeting old spies and things like that? Or is it,
it is partly, yeah. I'm meeting an old spy.
I mean, how do you meet an old spy? I mean,
I'm going to meet an old spy on Tuesday who's got who's promising to give me some information that will completely change perceptions of a crucial Cold War operation. So I'm kind of waiting for Crime Fest to finish so I can do that. But not really. But sometimes they're in the phone book. A lot of them. I mean, what's quite funny is that a lot of retired secret agents are now spending their time writing their memoirs, going to lectures and being on panels rather like this.
Indeed, we're going to have some, I believe, at Crime Fest.
Indeed, yeah. A lot of them are sort of engaging in very fierce debates in newsletters. For old spies, which is quite amazing to read. You know, I was there at the Berlin Wall in 1963, and you weren't there.
I was a treble agent.
Yeah, there's a lot of debate. I mean, there's still sort of really basic stuff about the Cold War, information that we don't know. There's sort of really famous operations that took place, really famous defectors, where it's absolutely split. Was this guy a real defector or was he a fake defector? Was this person a double agent or were they a real agent or were they a triple agent or a quadruple agent? And there's, those kind of issues, MI5, MI6, CIA, were basically torn apart for about 20 years. And those issues are still kind of burning. And it's a minefield. There's a very famous expression, the wilderness of mirrors, that CIA agent James Angleton came up with. And researching espionage is a wilderness of mirrors because, as I said before, you can read a memoir, which is sort of what you were saying, a whole eyewitness account, and you can read the next book you read will say, well, obviously that memoir you just read was a complete KGB propaganda job, and then the next book you read will say, well, obviously the one that you just read was a CIA job. you just go completely mad. So it's very difficult. But for the 60s stuff, I mean. I was born in 1973, so for me, 1969, it's before I was born, and it was, and it is history, and we're having this problem.
They're listening.
Sorry?
They're listening.
That's a bit scary.
This seems, as they're listening, I think we better change the subject, which I'm going to do very cleverly by asking the audience, you, to come in with a few questions now. May I remind you that the person, this is a threat, the person who asked the most interesting question will get this. So, have we any questions in the audience? Please, the lady in the second row.
When I'm reading historical crime fiction, I often wonder how much I can trust the history.
The lady is wondering, is saying that when she reads historical crime fiction, she often wonders, rather cynically I may say, how far she can trust the history. Well, I mean, can she trust you? Can she trust the history?
Well, she can trust me on 1972 because I'm old enough to remember it, and I'm starting to hate you more and more. Actually, not only are you boasting about the fact that you were born so many years after me, but you've also got this really exciting life, and you're meeting spies. It doesn't get that exciting in my house. There's a man coming to see me on Tuesday about new tiles for the bathroom, but that's really as good as it gets, you know.
Unless there's a body hidden behind the old tiles.
Kate, what about your history? Is your history good?
I hope so. Yeah, I do my best. I do my best to check everything. I'm on the Edwin School. I prefer books to the internet. If it is the internet, it's got to be a university site or something like that. But I try my best.
I'm very impressed. Yes. And so, madam, I think we can take that a resounding yes. Please.
The question I have is, how really important is it that your history be accurate? And how often have you played with history and deliberately distorted things so that you can get your point across. You're writing a story, you're writing something to entertain, rather than something to give us a school academic lecture.
Okay, how important is it that we get our history accurate, since we are, after all, writing to entertain? So surely it's okay if we change things to make, well, is it okay if we change things just to make it more fun for you and indeed for us? Well, I don't think it is myself, but
I'm very fussy about that. And and my wife sometimes says, I get very annoyed that something won't work because the history says it didn't happen. She says, well, why, what does it matter? You're writing a novel.
How do you feel, Edwin? Tom.
Dan.
He's not even honest.
Exactly. to answer the previous question, you can't trust a word I say. I've two views. My personal view for what I want to do with my books is that, to me, a lot of the power of the story comes from the reader being able to think, wow, this is actually true, or there's a lot of truth in this. And the more true it is, in a sense, to me, the more powerful the story is, because it feels like you're saying something about the real world. And I read a thriller recently where it was a sort of Dan Brown style thriller, but taking place in basically a location that just does not exist on Earth. And it's a exciting novel, but it's not, to me, it lacked power, because I'm thinking this place doesn't really exist, so there's no way this story could be true. So to me, the truer the story, the more the more exciting it is, because you think, and I think that's the genius.
More
of the
historically
adventure. Yeah.
Accurate. The
yeah.
The more depth of detail.
Exactly.
As well, yeah.
But that said, I think it really depends on what you, the author, want to do, and I don't think there's any hard and fast rule that says you should be accurate to the history if that's not what you want to do. When Julian Rathbone wrote these great novels, Last English King and Kings of Albion, in which he says in his footnote, basically, I've not done a lot of research and I've mucked around with the history to suit my agenda, because this is what I want to do. And I was absolutely fine with that.
What a man, eh? Okay, let's have another question. Can I have you, please? So you're asking, do people like fiction set on or drawing very heavily on the past because readers can connect what they read in the novel with what they know about the historical context and perhaps their own lives as well? Does that, let's see, Diane, what do you, how do you
see? I think there's sort of a whole gamut, really. This chimes I got a lot of sort of people wrote to me after Pull of the Moon and said, oh, this is just like it was when I was a teenager, which is
really?
A bit worrying as it's a book about murder, I thought. but I think people do like things which they can relate to. I think that's true as well of Sense of Place. My new one, Why Don't You Come For Me, is set in the English Lake District. And I think the geography of the place is also really important. And that I've already had people who've got in touch and said, I love this because it felt real and it reminded me of the place. And that interestingly comes back to an earlier question about how accurate do you actually have to be? And I've gone along a very sort of fine line where, in fact, some of the places are absolutely real and absolutely as they are, but there is, in fact, a hamlet where most of the people live, which is entirely fictional, although someone has already told me exactly where it is and what I've copied it from, which is kind of interesting. but I think you can get away with that as long as the reader doesn't feel they're being cheated and that you're really distorting things.
Yeah,
and I think that's where you do
yeah.
have to, particularly with things that are set in the present day, you've got to be careful that you don't make people want to suspend belief too much. You
right,
can't
yeah.
stray too far
it's
away.
It's a fine line, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yes.
Between I'm going to move on because we want to get as many questions in as we can. No, I want to have one at the back. Let's have one at the back. The lady, please, in the far corner at the back.
Do you have to have some connection with that?
Can I just ask you to explain that a little further? Do you mean, do we like to visit a particular part of the past,
yes,
physically, or just in our research? I see. Do we naturally feel that we're Edwardian gentlemen or knights in armour or ladies in? Yeah. Okay. That's a very interesting point. I mean, do we think? Do we have a particular link to a particular period, a particular set of characters, or something, a particular location in history? What do you think, Jeremy? I mean, you're the Cold War expert.
I think. You know, 15 years ago, I didn't know anything about the Cold War at all, and I became fascinated by it. So I think, yes, to write historical novels, I think you'd be foolish to do anything other than something that you're passionate and fascinated by. Whether or not that would be limited, I mean, I'm also fascinated by the Second World War and by various other things. But for my first novel, Free Agent, it's set in Nigeria during the Biafran Civil War. And I did grow up as a child in Nigeria, but after that war, and had heard about the war growing up, but didn't really know anything about it. And it wasn't my first choice to set the book in Nigeria or in that war. I was originally going to set it in the Congo. And a major reason why I did set it in Nigeria was because I felt more comfortable, even though I hadn't been there.
Yeah, but sorry, if I interrupt.
Sorry, yeah.
Could you see yourself actually moving out of the Cold War and choosing
I think in a new
series, say, the Second World War?
Yeah, I think so.
So you're not sort of necessarily wedded man and boy to the Cold War. You could sort of break out. You could see yourself
breaking out. I would hope so,
Yes, good. Kate, I mean, your books, because you link back to the past from the present, do you find yourself linking always back to the same?
No, I'm a dotter. I dot here and there. My particular interest is medieval and Tudor, but probably I've only done that in a couple of books. I tend to decide on a period and then research it, and as I research it, I become more and more interested in it and find it more and more fascinating.
So do you choose periods simply because you like to find out more about them?
Yes, almost. And it fits in with the theme of the story. The Viking book was about a Danish tourist that went missing.
Diane, I mean, your non-fiction books are very much investigating real life aspects of the Golden Age of murder, aren't they? The classic English murder.
Is that
your period?
Like Kate, actually, I'm very interested in medieval history and the Tudors too. But I think I could actually see myself writing something set in the first 30 years of the 20th century, because that is a fascinating period, particularly because of the contrasts, because you tend to sort of think that we've got modernity and motor cars and so on, but in rural areas, everything was still being done by horse and cart, no electricity, no running water. They were still living a Victorian life, and that kind of contrast also.
So you could see yourself moving around.
I could see myself jotting about anywhere, really, yeah.
And we already know from that you.
Yeah, I go all over the place.
I'm hesitating over your name. I'm just going to call you Sir.
Well, that's probably
the
best way.
Crime Writers Association, one should call him Sir anyway.
First time it's ever happened.
Yeah. Well, so you could move around, obviously.
Yeah, and I love that. I mean, my most sort of the earliest setting I've used is about 300 AD, and I've done sort of early Middle Ages, the late Middle Ages, Napoleonic Wars, and then written in present day as well. And they're all fascinating. And as Kate says, the more you find out about something, the more interesting it becomes to you, I think.
And the harder it is finding time actually writing the novel.
This is
the great problem with writing historical fiction. Do get absorbed in the research, and it's the ultimate make-work. You know, you can always find an excuse not to write. Can we have another question from the gentleman in the front row this time, please?
A couple of panels ago, one of the writers said their pet hate in novels was using real historical characters in their novels, either as detectives or as part of the window dressing. Do you agree, or would you like them to step outside for a few?
Oh, this is
Who was that?
If I can repeat the question, the in a previous panel, which is nameless, a nameless person asked whether the use of real historical characters as a detective or even as window dressing in a novel was an awful thing and something to be avoided. He called it a pet hate. How do we feel about that? Do we feel it's okay to use historical personages in our fiction? Should we crucify this person if we can find him? What's your view? Jeremy, would you like to?
I think they should read The Day of the Jackal, which is about de Gaulle. I think, of course, it can be overused and it can be done badly, but I think it's, if you're going to write, historical fiction, sometimes that might involve real historical figures.
Would you have General de Gaulle as a detective?
No, Darren, that wasn't the question, though. It was whether window dressing, having some sort of role. Diane, would you accept a historical character?
I would accept a historical character who was actually well and realistically drawn, and therefore I wouldn't really think of General de Gaulle as being one of my detectives. I don't think any of us can cast the first stone, because even if you're writing a fairly contemporary novel, it's likely that you're going to mention somebody who is factual or something factual that's going on. I mentioned Cat Stevens and Ralph McTell as musicians who happened to be around at the relevant time, which I guess could be marked up as window dressing. They don't appear in the novel, but they're there to give it weight and to give it reality, because that's the period. So I don't think I'm the person to cast the first stone on this, really.
Have you anything to add there, Kate?
Well, I think if it's part of the, if it fits in with the plot,
exactly.
And it doesn't feel forced.
And Edwin?
James. I'm going to take the person out for just to settle this like gentlemen, because I mean, it depends what you want to do. And certainly in my very first novel, which was set in Napoleonic Wars, I was very clear that I steered away from any kind of historically accurate people, because I didn't feel comfortable enough to be able, confident enough really, to be able to write them. Whereas now most of my historical novels, or aspect bits of my novels that are historical, focus a lot on real people who lived. And to me it's because usually there's some extraordinary event or extraordinary person in the past, and I'm interested in why it happened. And I think addressing it in fiction is one way of sort of investigating what their motives might have been, and why things might have turned out the way it did. I mean, an example, I've just been watching the HBO miniseries of Rome on DVD, which is, wildly over the top and completely preposterous.
Great stuff, though, isn't it?
And yet, having read a lot of that sort of late Republican Roman history, the way the characters are done, it kind of makes sense, and it sort of gives them a humanity to people, and a sort of a plausible way of why these people would have done the things they did and the way that the history evolved, and I think that's great.
If we remain in the same period, if you think about I, Claudius,
yeah.
Robert
yeah.
Graves, I mean, his novels were very well researched. He was a scholar. But I think treating Claudius and the court around him as fiction brought them to life in a way no non-fiction book could ever have done. It worked on an emotional level as well as on a purely historical level. Anyway, let's have another question. Amanda. In the past has caught our imaginations and inspired us to write about something linked to it, presumably.
Not necessarily a fictional variant
or something like that, yeah. Well, any particular real life murders?
Go ahead, Kate.
I haven't done one yet, but I think something like the Constance Kent
murder,
or even that coming from Liverpool, the
lucky enough actually to have one in the family. My my grandmother's family used to own a farm in Essex, which they sold in 1899 to a man who was a murderer called Samuel Henry Dougal, and an unfortunate woman who was his victim, Miss Holland. And so I grew up with that murder, in the sense my grandmother would say, you know, we've got our own murder, dear. I looked it up in the end, and actually looking at photographs of the corpse wrapped in sacking and that sort of thing, or seeing the farm, this really idyllic moated farmhouse, made me convinced I had to write a book that linked into it somehow, that somehow recreated it, reinvestigated it. And I did. And what I wanted to do in that book was actually look at it a little from the victim's angle, because I felt so sorry for the victim, this lovely middle-aged woman whose great problem was that she had a small fortune, £6,000, and that made her a prey for a con man, a lethal con man. And all she wanted was love. It's the saddest story in the world, and I wanted to write that. Anyway, let's have another question. Dolores. This is another very interesting question. How easy do we find it when writing novels set in the past to get not only the, as it were, the external facts right, but also the psychological attitudes of the time, what people were actually thinking and feeling, as opposed to the clothes they wore,
yeah,
or the carriages and so on. Jeremy, I mean,
it's extremely difficult. I mean, you need an awful lot of facts. I find I probably use about 10% of the research I do in the book, and the 90% I discard is hopefully creating an atmosphere where you feel this is really 1969.
Yeah, but what about the psychological attitudes,
yeah, but I mean,
of the characters?
Well,
I think they look at women, say, in an espionage.
Yeah, but I mean, that's also facts.
Yeah.
You just amass, you have to, you know, watch an awful lot of films and read an awful lot of memoirs. And if you read, you know, 100 memoirs of people at the time, you will get a psychological, you know, you will get a feeling for what it was like, other than just, you know, this was where MI6's headquarters were. You know, the language that they used, language has changed, you know, since 1969, in quite subtle ways sometimes. I also found a lot of stuff has just disappeared. You know, films, even relatively famous films, that you can't watch anymore. You know, they're not on DVD for whatever reason. There's a lot of stuff that you have to spend an awful lot of time digging. And I think I just find the more you do, the more you dig, the more you read, the more you watch, eventually it sort of seeps through. But there's no sort of shortcut to it, I don't think.
Would anyone else like to add to that very interesting answer?
Yes, it's the attitudes as well.
It's the attitudes,
yes,
yeah.
And the mindset.
Yeah.
Like medieval time was a great age of faith. And
yeah.
You know, that sort of mindset. Also political correctness.
Oh, yeah.
Some of the things people used to say back in the...
I mean, one of the things I find fascinating is the more you look into even relatively recent periods of history, what people were thinking and feeling, is just how incredibly alien it is.
Yeah.
Oh, I just disagree.
It is, but I think it's extraordinary. I mean, in the Middle Ages, it was an age of faith. Everything.
Yeah, but you still see that.
When you died, you go to heaven or hell, or maybe purgatory.
I think we can overemphasize that, though. And I think, first of all, you can still see that in the modern world. And, you know, there are plenty of places in the world, even in the Western world, where you can see people where faith is the overriding kind of driver of what they do, be it kind of, you know, fundamentalist America or Afghanistan or whatever. So I hold with the kind of idea that human nature doesn't change terribly much. And I think, reading some a Platonic dialogue yesterday, as it happens, and
four.
But the thing that struck me is that this is written 2,500 years ago, and it still speaks to me. I understand what he's doing. I understand his motivation. To me, there's nothing alien about what he's saying to me at all. He sounds, as I say, just like someone I might meet in the pub.
Okay, well, I'm going to stop there because we have reached time, and we've moved in this wonderful session from fishnet tights to Plato. This has never been done before in Crimefest. Now, before we all go away, I'm going to present this prize to the lady at the back in the corner, because I thought her question was particularly interesting, but it could have gone to several other members of the audience, so don't feel bad if you haven't gone away without this. It could so easily have been